This podcast is sponsored by El Spelio. If you go to elspelio.com, you can see the three lights that they offer, the three different models. Mine is the Terra, which is the least expensive of the three, but all of them are pro-grade instruments for illuminating your path when you go caving, be it for exploration or recreational caving. It really is. It's great for all applications, and I love my El Spelio Terra. There's also the Rescue SAR, there's the Lunatic, and right now all lights at elspelio.com are $20 off when you use the promo code PODCAST at checkout. In fact, any order of $300 or more, if you spend $300 or more on regularly priced items at elspelio.com, you'll save $20 with the promo code PODCAST at checkout. Get the last light you will ever need to buy. High quality El Spelio custom cave lights at elspelio.com. Enjoy. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. My name is Matt Pelser, your host. I am from the Central Indiana Grotto. What's a grotto? A grotto is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. What do we do? Well, we like to go in caves. We like to crawl around in caves, walk in caves, climb in caves. All, you know, moving through caves is different from moving through normal terrain. And we like that. We like that very, very much. And if you're interested in that and you've never heard of a grotto, or if you've never been on a wild trip in a cave and you want to see what it's all about, what you need to do is you need to get in touch with people who do it. Just going into a cave, not knowing what you're doing, can be problematic. There's a list of things you should really bring, or a list of things at least that you should consider, clothing-wise, equipment-wise, different things like that. And you really should just get introduced to it by people who know what they're doing. They're not going to be elitist with you. They're not going to be they're going to be cool. Okay, cavers are cool people, and there are people in most grottos who are very willing to take new people. Find that person in your local grotto, but first find your local grotto and get in touch with the leadership to point you to that person. You can find your local grotto by going to caves.org. Easy to remember, caves.org. That's the National Speleological Society website, and there you can find your local grotto. And you can ask questions, and I encourage that. So go to caves.org, find your local grotto. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. So get in touch with people who do and learn that way. It's the best way to learn. Chrissy Richards is our guest this month. She is a cave diver, and she was incredible to talk to. Great insight. Cave divers are typically really chill people, I've found, but I haven't talked to a lot of them. So if you're laughing at that characterization, then maybe I just haven't talked to enough of them yet. But Chrissy was cool. She was great. She was willing to share an awful lot, which you're about to hear. Today is, well, if you're listening to this on the day that it comes out, December the 1st, today is Giving Tuesday, and that counts for your local grotto, or also your local Karst Conservancy, be it the SCCI or the Indiana Karst Conservancy. That's the one that I belong to, although I also belong to the SCCI. All of these organizations could use a little extra help. Karst Conservancies, grottos, the NSS. So please consider them in your giving this time of year, on this Giving Tuesday or throughout the month of December. Or really, if you're listening to this far flung out of the holidays, consider a donation. If you're listening to this and it's not the holidays, chances are not a lot of people are thinking about giving to these organizations, and you might swoop in and just look like a daggone hero. So consider giving to the organizations that give you so much in your life. Oh man, so much is going on. This is I'm taping this on December the 1st, Giving Tuesday. Last Wednesday was my last day at my old job. I was a talk show host on Indiana Public Broadcasting, and it was great. It was a wonderful opportunity, but a new opportunity came along, and I had to take it. I can't say exactly where it is now, but I will say that it is another radio station, and it is a radio station that that you can hear in every nook and cranny of my favorite parts of the state, which include Cave Country. Now, you can't hear it in the caves, of course, but on your way to the caves, Cave Country, Indiana, you can hear this radio station, and I'm going to be, I've probably already said too much for anyone who might be somewhat familiar with the radio scene in Indiana. I might have already said too much, but I'm excited about this new job. I did get to do a cave show on the old talk show, though. So if you want to check that out, you can. The talk show that I used to host is called All In. It's still around. They're looking for another host. And I did a show on the show caves of Indiana. There are four show caves in Indiana: Blue Spring, Marengo, Squire Boone, and Indiana Caverns. Indiana Caverns and Blue Spring are owned by a couple friends of mine, cavers. Sam Freshour, who also wrote Caves and Karst, Guide to Caves and Karst of Indiana, and Gary Robertson owns Indiana Caverns, and he wrote 50 Years Under the Sinkhole Plain, and he's been exploring Binkley, which is where Indiana Caverns is. It's part of the Binkley Cave System, which is the longest cave in Indiana, just past 45 miles. And so I had both of them on the air statewide, which was really, really cool. So if you want, you can search All In. There are a lot of podcasts called All In. Ours has a blue and black logo with quotation marks around it. One of the quotation marks looks like the state of Indiana. So that was our show. And you can look around for that if you want to check that one out. But that was kind of cool because it was a live conversation and we got some cool audience interaction, emails, voicemails, and things like that. So I got this 2 weeks off in between jobs, which was really going to be exciting for me. I wanted to do a backpacking trip. I have two kids, but I had an arrangement with my wife who said, yeah, I mean, absolutely. You should go and do that. I've been getting some cabin fever, some wanderlust. And so I'm like, all right, I want to do this. And she's like, yeah, absolutely. Just fine. Incidentally, she also quit her job on the same day as me. She left her old job on the same day as me. She's starting a new one this week. And of course, a kid in my son's daycare preschool tested positive for COVID. So they shut down for 2 weeks. So this 2 weeks, instead of going backpacking or working on a couple other projects that I wanted to work on, I've got to be Papa now, which is fine. Totally fine. It's just I was really, really wanting to get a couple things done, maybe get out, do some hiking with the dog. Just didn't end up working out. So anyway, I'm eager to start the new job, but man, this me time that I was looking forward to has just completely been dashed. Grottos, if you are looking for someone to do a presentation, I did one this past month. I did one for the Cleveland Grotto. It was great. I've got a couple more lined up. So if you want to have me talk about the caving podcast and talk about guests that I've had on and share a few clips and things like that, I've got about a 1 hour presentation. I try to keep it under an hour. You know how these things go sometimes. I'd be more than willing to do it for you virtually and just get in touch with me. I'm in the directory. You can find my email address and we'll set that up. Chrissy Richards, we talk about Florida. We talk about TAG. We talk about Mexico. We talk about Hawaii. She has been in a lot of places. She's a caver, of course. She's also a cave diver. One of the best. Her and her husband, Jason, they do it. And they do it right. And because you can't do it wrong. You cannot do it not right. Otherwise, consequences. So we talk about that. We talk about the danger of it. We talk about all kinds of great stuff. So here is me and Chrissy Richards. Chrissy Richards, welcome to the Caving Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
How long have you been caving? When did you get started?
I actually went to my first wild cave in 1998. My then boyfriend took me to Climax Cave in South Georgia.
Aha. Uh-huh. How was that for you?
It was horrible. we did. There's an entrance climb down that a lot of people use a rope now, and he told me just to stem down. And I'm petrified of heights. Helmet's too big. You know, it's basically when you crawl, it's over one eye. He's like, you have to go fast through this area because people get histoplasmosis here.
Is that the guano thing?
Yes, right.
Oh, like, God. Like, so you were crawling through guano?
On your first trip?
God.
He was like, well, he's a caver. And he was just like, I wanted to see, you know, how you would do. And I was just like, this is horrible. what are you doing to me? Like, you're going to kill me.
The amazing thing, Chrissy, is that you went back and now you've done so much, which we'll get to this hour. But my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, so, yeah, okay. I guess. Tell me more about that first trip. Like what went through your head? You said it was horrible. But obviously something stuck with you that kept you going at it.
You know, I think back then, and I just had a problem saying no. I was very stubborn. I did not want something to defeat me. So, I kind of just kept going. And so, yeah, like, I think the crux was when we're going through this squeeze, and you know, it's one of those squeezes where when you're going down, you can just slide down it. But when you're coming up, you have to have like both arms in front of you, and you kind of have to like wiggle your way through this hole. You know, there's no room. It's not big enough for everything. And I was wearing one of those old, the Just Rights with the battery pack on your hip.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had to pull that. I had to take it off and push it through because the hole was so small. And he started pulling on it, which caused the neck strap to like start to choke me out as my arms are pinned above my head. And I'm like, stop. I don't know why I came back. I have no idea. I was exhausted. I was totally out of shape, not in any kind of caving shape. And I was just like, this is... All right, let's go again.
No, you can be in tip top shape. What is considered tip top shape on your first caving trip, and you're still not in enough shape because you're using muscle groups and in combinations that no one ever feasibly should use for any reason.
Correct.
So it makes perfect sense. Okay, so how long was that trip? I mean, you said you were exhausted. I wasn't exhausted after my first trip. I was a little tired, but how long were you in there?
I want to say it was maybe a couple hours.
Oh, not that bad.
You know, I blocked it out. It wasn't that bad, but I was definitely out of shape. And I think the whole trauma of having to climb up and down this, you know, it's like a chimney. I think that I remember the most, and then the crawling.
Yeah.
Yes.
So were you with this guy for very long?
I'm married to him.
Yeah. I didn't, for those listening, I didn't know the answer to that question. I was not setting her up for a joke. That was organic. Oh, that's great. Okay. So then what came next? Okay. So maybe that didn't hook you, but you obviously did it again, and maybe the next trip did, or was it after that when you really kind of felt serious?
I think what happened was I grew up and I was like, I was pretty shy. You know, I was stubborn, but I wasn't, I didn't have a lot of confidence growing up. And the more I did it, the more I felt like just confident. It was weird. It was like little small goals that you were reaching. And one summer, you know, it was always kind of a struggle. And one summer I went caving all the time. It was like one of those times where it starts to click and you start to go all the time. And I got better and better and better. And then it was like, I can do this. I feel better. I feel confident. I feel great. And, you know, the more you talk about to people, like what makes you cave, the more. And it was like when you're caving, you don't think of anything else, right? You just think of caving. And so it was one of the few things I could do that actually did that for me. You know, it's so hard to say. It's like it just happened.
Yeah. People get hooked for different reasons. And I think it sounds like to me you're a challenge person. And
yes.
Yeah. And all right. So when you get started, for me anyway, and for a few other people that I've talked to, the hook comes maybe not on the very first trip, but on the first like kind of hard trip. What was that one for you?
Oh, I would say because within a couple years, I joined Peter Sprouse on an expedition to the Sistema Purificacion.
Oh my gosh! So you went all the way. You went to Mexico
Yeah. And just the caving out there was so amazing.
Mm.
Again, handed me my behind because I'm from Florida and elevation training, you just can't, just like, you know, but I mean, just the differences in the passages within the same cave, it you know, giant moon pools that you can't even walk across. You have to like climb around the edges of them. They're, you know, they're 15 feet across. It was just gorgeous.
Oh.
And I was just blown away by it.
Oh my gosh. But okay. So I'm jumping around a little bit. So those,
that's okay.
Those early years, you're in Florida. Where's Climax?
Yes. South Georgia.
Oh, South Georgia. Okay. Okay.
So really close to the panhandle. I went to the University of Florida, so I was in Gainesville.
So is that where the diving thing comes into?
Well, so my husband was a cave diver and
also Florida.
Also Florida. He moved to Florida to cave dive.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he is like really into the cave diving. He's really good at that. So he's been doing that forever. So when he was doing that when I met him, and I was like, I'll help you get to the sump, you know, I'll help you do the cave diving or whatever it needs to do. And then it's another trip. Mm-hmm. I went to Mexico and there was a sump exploration and I helped carry tanks. And I want to say that the entrance drop was about 300 feet and we're carrying like 80s up and down the pit. And him and this other guy, Pete Chiflett, went and found over a kilometer of virgin borehole passage.
Oh,
and I was
boy.
Like, screw this. If I'm carrying tanks, I'm going. You know, because carrying tanks really sucks.
Yeah,
it really sucks.
If you're bringing cave diving gear, you're just sucking up all the resources.
Oh, dude, it sucks. Yes, yes. And so, like, you know, we didn't have any bags back then. We're just kind of like hauling them by their neck, and it was just miserable. So then I came back to Florida, and I learned how to cave dive.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean. Oh, I've never done it. I don't know that I ever will. I don't want to say it terrifies me, but it's I don't know, the idea of it's a little scary just because, you know, just knowing it hasn't turned out well for some people, you know?
Correct. Correct. And there's a lot of my friends who think the same thing, only they are very, they're not as nice as you. They just say I'm crazy. So.
Well, that's not helpful for them to say that. But I mean, it also takes for someone to be successful with it, it takes, you keep calm. You've got a low resting heart rate.
Yes.
Nothing gets you too excited. That
yes.
kind of thing. Would you put yourself into that category?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely one of those, like, I actually find it kind of relaxing, you know? I mean, if you think about it, when you're going through a low area that's about, you know, 3 feet tall, it's like that. You know, that crawl, you can't really get on your hands and knees, but you can't exactly, you know, you're low crawling, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in cave diving, you're just floating around and you just kind of kick a little.
Yeah. Yeah.
I call it my lazy caving.
Well, I kind of prefer a water-filled crawl because there's the buoyancy, you know, and
right.
you got
right.
a little assist from
exactly.
Archimedes, so...
It can be exciting and yeah, you're right. I mean, it basically takes it's got a lot of risks to it. So it's not something that, you know, you just want to jump in and do. And so there's a lot of training involved and a lot of continuous, you know, you have to keep up with your training. You can't just like go cave diving and then, you know, wait a few years and go again and expect to do exploration. You know, you definitely need to get back into that mindset because a lot of things can go wrong.
And that's, you know, it's, I've never heard that about it, but it makes perfect sense. It's like ballet. There's a grace to it, of course, but there's also a fitness level to it mentally and physically.
Yes.
So I don't know. What did that evolution look like for you? I mean, from the first trip to present day, what got you up to speed?
Well, so because I grew up around the water and I was diving, and I feel like dry caving beforehand really helped me with the sump diving part because I'm, you know, as a dry caver, we can be used to these smaller spaces and not freak out, right?
Sure.
Like, you know, there are people who tell me they can't go dry caving because there's a ceiling over their head. Like they feel like the walls are all closing in on them. And underwater, it's kind of the same thing, you know, because I already have that in my toolbox, the caving part mentality, diving it is just another step forward. And so the cave diving, especially in beautiful, clear, wonderful water, it's like, it's an easy thing for me. And it hooks a lot of people once they go through it and they see, you know, if you can get a chance to see underwater formations. And it's just, there's a beauty about it that you can't explain to anyone who's never seen it, unfortunately. But yeah, I kind of started off just cave diving around Florida and then jumped into the sump diving rather quickly. And like my first sump dive was also horrible.
Where
like,
was it?
Like, oh, great. It was the bottom of Fern Cave.
Oh.
Yeah. So that, you know, the Fern Cave has a resurgence at the bottom, and it was like just muddy, you know, but we knew it kind of went through. And as my husband and I, as a team, we went through and connected and surveyed all that part or resurveyed that part because they had done that exploration before. So we were basically resurveying.
You were going where people had been before.
Yeah. So we knew it did connect. We didn't know the way because there's no more line left in that all gets blown out.
Right.
And there was a small sump in the very beginning, which was really muddy, and we got through. And then we found a way to dig it open so that some people could come in and help us survey the dry section. And then it sumps again. And when you come to the other side of that sump, you're at the bottom of Fern Cave. and we were basically like surveying in our PolyPro at that point because you have to take everything off.
Oh, gosh. So that was the first sump dive. You said zero visibility. Very muddy.
Yes. Yes. Like you have a light on underwater, but it really just looks like, you know, like if you go out to a mud puddle and you stick your face in it with a mask on and you turn on a light, that's how it's going to look.
Oh my God.
Just like that. Like, and you're basically just feeling around. You kind of like put your hand out, and some people like to close their eyes because they get nervous with the mud. But I just keep, I don't know. I like to have my eyes open.
Yeah. But how much room was there? Was it wide open, or were you kind of?
Oh, no, no, no. It was probably about 2 feet wide and about 3 feet tall.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, yeah.
You're not really swimming. Yeah. You're kind of crawling, but you're completely submerged in water.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Gosh.
So you know that you have your tank and your that one, we just kind of, you know, I mean, you kind of push one tank in front of you and hold on to another tank so you have a backup.
Mm.
Yeah. So a lot of those things you have to adjust.
Yeah.
Adjust your configuration, I should say. So, and at least you're not worried about stirring it up because it's already gone.
So what came next in the sump diving world?
Yeah, I would say Blue Spring was the next one.
Huh?
The Blue Spring resurgence in Tennessee, that was the original exploration of over 5,000 feet. So it was one of those entrances where I could get in just fine. Some of the other people, Marbury Harding joined us, and he had to sit at the entrance underwater and bang open the entrance. So, because it was just a tiny opening. So, you know, we're basically hammering underwater. And this had been surveyed by some cave divers in the beginning years ago. Woody Jasper had put some line in there, and the visibility is notoriously bad. Tennessee, the problem with the caves there is that as soon as it rains, you get a lot of turbidity from surface water inputs. Mm. So they came to what they thought was just a wall and, you know, and ended it and came out. And it's kind of a murky, it can be milky blue at times. It's never really super clear. And we just hit that 1 year during a drought, and we got to the end of their line. We'd kind of resurveyed it, and we looked to the left, and there to the left is just this open passage at the top of this small little hill. And that really got me hooked because you hear the reel unwinding in your hand And it's just like this zing, you know, it's just this, you realize, you know, no one's been here. This is the first time it's ever been seen. And I think that really, really got me hooked.
I know that you made a connection in Blue Spring. This wasn't it yet?
Well, that wasn't it yet. We ended up dumping a lot of line in there to get to the first air pocket was insulting, is what we call it. It was kind of a small, because we were three stages back. So you have to start carrying a lot of tanks the farther you get back, because there's some safety guidelines that you do with cave diving is you dive a third in and you dive a third out and you save a third of your tank for emergencies.
Sure, sure, sure.
So the farther you get back, the more air you have to take. So at this point we were doing setup dives. So we would go in and drop off stages. Because of the size of the entrance, you had to like shuttle bottles. So my husband, Jason, had his breather on, and then we would bring in like extra tanks for me. And so I had about two stages behind. So about two stages in, and then I had my back gas, and we hit this beach, and you have to walrus. Oh, I mean, you are just like a walrus, because I have two steel 95s. They're, you know, 60 pounds each. So you just have to and I don't want to take them off and crawl over and put them back on. So I basically just dragged myself over this sand beach and plopped into the water very ungracefully to the other side.
And you're stirring up silt when this happens too, right?
Yes. Ugh. Yeah, yeah, you are. So you trying to be nice about it, but at the same time, you're just like, screw it. We're going to go. So,
oh, yeah, you're there.
We're there. We're going. And the water is coming at you. Some of those when they're, right, so it's flowing out. Mm. So leaving is bad visibility, but coming in, you're constantly getting fresh water.
Okay, yeah, so all right. Really, I didn't think about that.
So, yeah, so like the silt is going out. So we got into another dry passage, and there was no way we could continue swimming. We actually had to get out of the water. And on another trip, we ended up going to that section and dragging another set of tanks to the far side. And then he dove the next sump because we just didn't have enough ability to carry everything over and over. I mean, like that last haul, the tanks were so heavy and we're in our dry suits. You feel sick to your stomach because you get overheated really quickly because
yeah.
You're in a dry suit, but you don't want to take the dry suit off. When you come out on the other side of the sump and you're in a dry suit, the problem is as soon as you get out of the water, you're putting yourself at risk, because if you tear your dry suit, that could cause big issues for a long swim back. Mm. Short swims, okay, you might fill up your suit, but it's gonna suck. But a long swim could be very dangerous. So you don't want to have an entire suit full of water because you won't be able to swim.
Oof.
So yeah, getting out of the sump on the other side, like a lot of times we would get out of our dry suits and then continue on in you wear your dry cave clothes underneath and continue on. So after the next sump, then it connected to the main passage of Blue Spring.
Oh, wow.
I know. I will say it was the CR passage. So it was meant to be, because it's the Chrissy Richards.
So, okay. On that trip where you did that sump, how long did it take to get the gear to where you're diving? Was it a long haul?
Yes. Yeah. It's it's underwater. You're swimming for about an hour.
Really?
An hour. Yeah. An hour and a half.
Wow.
And then, yeah, the whole trip itself, by the time we got done surveying, there was a lot of people waiting at the surface, which, you know, I want to say it was a good 8 or 10 hours.
Wow. But to get the gear there, I mean, how many other people did you have on the trip to help carry everything? I guess is what
we just pull
say.
Up. Like to get to this sump?
Yeah.
Or to the original, you drive up and you jump in.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yes. We're diving from outside. Sorry. We're diving from outside. I'm sorry. I forget that you don't know this one.
No, I don't know this one. I haven't been to Blue Spring yet.
Okay. Okay. So Blue Spring is this beautiful, like massive cave, right? And if you go down the road, you'll find this spring that comes out. And it was always speculated that it was connected to the cave, the dry section of the cave somewhere. Bill Walter had his suspicions on where this connected. And so he took us there on a dry cave trip and was like, this is where I think it is. And he was correct. That's exactly where we came up. So when you go to the cave, you drive down the road and you just park right there and you can just plop right in. But the entrance is a Z bend. So you go straight down. Oof. And it's only like a couple feet wide. So you know, the way we dive, our tanks are on the side of our bodies. You know, you don't have a high profile. So like I could just drop in, but then you hit the ground and you have to basically knee bend or Z bend into the passage there.
Oh.
And it's really low and then it opens up.
Yeah.
So it's a filter. It's a restriction filter for most people. And that was the entrance that Marbury had to use a sledge underwater to open up so that he could get in.
So, oh my goodness.
So, I know.
Wow.
So yeah. So it's, you know, as far as, you know, carrying gear there, it's not a big deal at all.
No.
So.
But making that connection, that seems like that was a big deal for you.
It was actually, it was definitely one of those challenges, you know, and it sucks because we actually have more passage to go explore in there. So there's still, I know.
Well, now you're on Hawaii time.
I know.
How long is it going to be until you get back there?
Jason retires next year.
Okay.
We're looking to retire. Hopefully maybe Chattanooga.
Oh, that'd be, there you go. You'd be right down there in it.
yeah, that's the hope.
So why are you in Hawaii, just out of curiosity?
My husband's military.
Oh, okay. All right. So that's why. Do you do any lava tubing out there?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, actually we do. Yep. Yeah. Mostly on the Big Island. We live on Oahu. On Oahu, we have mapped some flank margin caves. So all their caves here on Oahu are really kind of old. The underwater stuff is pretty small and it's all seasonal. The underwater stuff is seasonal because the North Shore starts ripping about in the winter and you can't go dive it because the waves are way too big.
Ah.
And because it's shallow, as soon as it turns surgy, it can be a little hazardous. So
imagine.
Definitely it can be.
So have you been on any of the major stuff on the Big Island? You've done like survey stuff in some of those big lava tubes there.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, Pat Kimbesis came out and we helped her with a survey project on the Big Island. She had a permit with the Forest Service over there. And so we did a whole, and Virgin, just this thing that just keeps going.
Yeah.
So
she just did our a grotto presentation for us and the CIG on that trip. It was awesome.
Oh,
I didn't know that was you. Yes. That's fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's us. So yeah, that was such a great place and it really, really interesting. But you know, everything on the lava tubing is got its own different types of hazards that you're not used to. So,
well, yeah, the most,
it's been a learning curve.
The part for me that was intriguing was the way you guys negotiated the crawls with those, what do they call them? Those like sledding things.
Yes, the sledders, the sliders or the super sliders or something like that.
Yeah, they're like, yes. Can you describe those for people who don't know what the hell we're talking about?
It's a sheet of flexible plastic.
Okay.
It's thick enough. It's thicker than a tarp, but it's thin enough that you can roll it up and band it together and kind of put it in your pack, right?
Yeah.
So, and it's shorter than, it's like a small camp mat size, right? It's got a little handle at the top and they're cheap. They're cheap and it's easy to slide over the lava with it, but man, without it, you are just murdering yourself.
Yeah, it would be, I mean, I don't know. Would you say it would be impossible without them?
No, not impossible, but
extremely difficult.
Extremely.
And you'd
difficult.
Be left pretty bloody in a few spots.
Yes. There, we had multiple times where we ended up bloody on, because we didn't, you know, some of the times we didn't have them because you don't know what you're coming to. So we would only carry certain gear until we were like, oh, I wish we had those.
So what was the technique? So we're talking about crawling over sharp lava with these things. And so you have two. So you slide over one and then you pull the one from behind in front of you.
Yes. And then kind of go that way. Or you can, there were times when I could just hold on to it and push it, you know, kind of push it with my arms so that you can be, you know, down. So you have different techniques of doing it that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Oh yeah.
Is it clear like mud?
Believe me, as a caver, you figure it out in the moment. You go in with an yes. idea, and that completely changes the first few minutes you're doing it. And then it's like,
exactly.
All right, we found a better way. Thank goodness. Let's do it this way.
Yes. Yeah. That was it. We were really lucky. We really didn't have to use, on the section that we did, we didn't really have to use them.
Oh, well, that's good. But this was a cool, this was a cool project though, as I understand it. I mean, you just kept going, and then eventually you had to stop, but there was more passage in front of you. I mean, there's more there.
Giant. Like, well, I mean, okay, not giant, but like
big enough to fit through. That's giant enough.
It's and a good, you know, 15 feet tall and about 25 feet wide.
That's giant enough.
Big, right? Yeah. That's giant enough. I'm not going to turn that down, right? You know, look at that and say, you know what? We should just stop.
But you did. You had to.
Yeah, we had to. Well, and we're very big on survey as you go.
Yeah. You know? Yes, of course.
I mean, it's fine if you want to scout around the corner and look down and say, okay, yeah, it doesn't just end. Like, we're not going to do a massive, like, should we end right here or should we look around the corner and see? But yeah, that's it. This is an ice cream store. No scooping. No scoops.
What was this system called again? I can't remember.
They called it the 1984
That's
flow.
Right. That's right.
But it's the Puka Palace. They had a different name for each one. So it's Puka Palace was, I think, the one that we were working on. And we did enough underground that actually for a while there, it was easier. We took a day and bushwhacked over the surface to find another entrance into this cave. And that actually made it an easier, although it's, you know, debatable if it's easier to walk over this, over lava or underneath it.
That's what's so crazy to me about, I don't know, the Hawaii lava tube caving on the Big Island is that you're talking about rocks that are not very old at all.
Right, right. And they fall in, right? Like you can actually break an ankle, like walking around. So when you're trailblazing, you know, you have a machete and a walking stick and you're basically poking around trying to make sure there's not a hole in front of you so you don't just step into something. Mm. It's very slow going.
Yeah. But, well, you're talking about slow going to get to the cave or are you talking about slow going caving too?
A little bit of both, but the poking for holes is all on the surface. When you're trying to find a new entrance, because we knew that there has to be something by the LIDAR and looking at the aerials, we're like, well, let's go check this area because if we can walk to it, we can actually get to the end of our survey faster than if we were to go underground because of all the crawling and and having to deal with that.
Sure. So exciting though.
Yeah.
You do a lot of that now that you're there in Hawaii?
Not as much as I would like.
Well, of course.
Especially since the COVID, but mostly because being on Oahu, there's some here, but the stuff here is a lot more sensitive. Mm. They did a lot of burials of, you know, they're more ingrained in Hawaiian culture than the lava tubes on the Big Island are new.
Yeah.
And here they have a lot of historic, implications. And so, you know how like in Indiana and some of these places, you go ridge walking and you go out and you find a cave and you can just go in the cave. If you do that here and get caught, it's $1,000 fine.
Well, not to mention a trust issue from there on out.
Not to mention a trust issue. Not to mention you would be like enemy number one to Hawaiian homelands, and so it's a little more political out here. So we just try to get in the water. Yeah. Just like we know there's nothing in there, so we're good.
Have you done any caving in Indiana?
You know, I have. I went to convention in Indiana.
2007?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. That storm? Yes.
I was not there. I actually had not. I was not a caver in 2007. I got started a few years later, but I wish I had been to the But was it? Isn't there always a storm at convention, no matter where it is, though?
Yes, it feels like it.
I did not. I guess I didn't know that there was a storm. Oh no, I did because they had it in some of those big limestone rooms down near.
Yeah, Yes, they had it in the. It was in the mine.
Yeah.
In the mine. Yeah. So, and nobody, you know, like half the people didn't even know what was going on until we came outside. We're like, uh-oh. I guess that one was better than West Virginia, you know, when it almost blew everyone away.
Oh, I know. I remember hearing about that. And so what did you remember what you did in Indiana?
I do not.
No.
There was a water. It was definitely a river cave.
That narrows it down.
I know. It's a big river cave. How's that?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it's got some swimmy parts to it. And I think that they used to bring in canoes.
Oh, okay. That one might be Blue Spring. Indiana's Blue Spring Caverns.
It might be.
But there's other caves where that happens too in Indiana. So who knows? But I don't know. I always like to ask about Indiana whenever I can, whenever anyone voluntarily brings it up. I'm like, okay, what'd you do?
What'd you do? And I'm like, oh, man.
Well, I mean, in Indiana,
I hate getting old.
A lot of times they all kind of look the same here in Indiana. Well, in some places, depending on the rock, I guess. But, you did some stuff in Snail Shell too, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, there's still stuff going on there.
Yeah, so yeah.
That's another project. Yeah, the last one was really good. We had a whole bunch of volunteers to help us carry. So I don't know, since you don't seem to know, let me explain Snail Shell.
Sure, please.
So do you know anything about, like, the entrance is this giant sinkhole outside of Nashville that doesn't look like it belongs anywhere near Murfreesboro or Nashville.
Really?
So south of Nashville and Murfreesboro. Yeah, it's huge. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And it's at a part of the cave where actually there's the river kind of goes, and they count it as one because there's a ledge and the river kind of goes under the ledge. So technically the two entrances are connected.
Okay.
And so you have an upstream and a downstream. And so we were going upstream, and it is a full-on river cave. Like, you are never out of the water. You are always at least ankle or knee deep or full-on swimming. And the very first part is, I think, a 2,500-foot swim. And it is cold.
Really?
Like, people lower, it's so big, people lower kayaks in there and kayak.
Oh, my word. Oh, yeah. Okay, so I'm looking at pictures. Yes, the entrance is gorgeous. And I see some canoes and kayaks. So what did you do there?
So they were resurveying, and the first couple tries we did a resurvey. And then the last one, we got a bunch of people to carry. We took dry suits in because we knew we would be on the far side of the sump. It's a dry section, and then it looks like a sewer tunnel, only you can't touch the bottom. And there's really nothing to hold on to. And I will say that before this trip, it was the one time I didn't have a life jacket back there. And I was like, this is how people drown. Like, oof. You're just so tired swimming and swimming and swimming and swimming and swimming. So the next time we're like, okay, we're all going to have dry suits. We brought an inflatable boat. We stuffed it through the sump and then carried gear on it and surveyed the tube. And then Jason did the push dive. And so I think we had like 10 people each day. We had 10 people go in with all of us, carry gear to the sump, which is 2 miles to the sump, drop it off, come back. The next day, just the divers went in, and it was Mark Wenner, Brian Williams, Jason Richards, and I. And we go past and carry all the gear to the end and resurvey the tube to connect it all together, because it was like there were sections of survey, but tying them in didn't seem to work out. So we had to resurvey all that, then push it, and then come all the way out, leave our gear there, and then the next day come in with another group of people, pick up all the gear, and go out.
That's a long haul, too. I mean, how rough
but
is...
But you can't camp there.
No, you can't.
To get out of the water.
Oh, my gosh. So are you talking about 2 miles of swimming or paddling?
It's like swimming and then walking and then climbing over stuff and then floating under stuff and then potholes and sandy bottoms. As I told, so like one of the times I went, Mike Young came out from Arkansas and he's like, I'm just going to drag this thing behind me. And I was like, uh-huh. He's like, you know, I can drag this thing. I've dragged it through stuff. And I'm like, look, this is not a hard cave. Like, it's not hard to get there, but it's long. It's not a sprint. It is a marathon. It takes hours to get there. And then at the end, you have like this waterfall climb up that you got to get to. And it's just physically taxing. And so if you think that you're just going to race through there with, you know, 50 pounds of gear, that's not going to happen.
Easy does it.
Yeah, easy does it. Easy there. So, and he was absolutely exhausted by the end. And he never came back. I was like, where are you? And we have done it in like the worst times because sometimes the, you know, we're trying to go in low water. And we did it in January one time. Ugh. And that was super tough. That was so cold that when we got out, you know, you see that sinkhole. And I thought, man, if I get out, I'm gonna like slide because I'm wet. I'm soaking wet. And what was happening was actually I was freezing to the rock. And what? By the time I got to the car, yeah, I couldn't get my life jacket off because it had frozen shut. I mean, it was just like, I was like, this is really dumb.
Why'd we pick January? Maybe April would be a slightly better idea.
I know. That was so dumb.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, how far away are you parked from this big entrance to Snail Shell? I mean, are you just
far enough to, no, far enough to get lost.
Yeah. Oh, God. So it's not like you're at the top of the hill and you walk down and there it is, but yeah. No.
There is a path to it. It's just really hard to follow back at night when you're cold.
Uh-huh.
And brain fuzzy. So like getting there, especially during the day, it's not that far. It's not a hard walk, 5 minutes maybe to get down, you know, it's not a pull up and hop over, but it's definitely not, it's not any struggle to get to it. But that night on the cold night, I definitely had a brain fart. This other girl and I like got out and I was like, uh-oh, this is not the way to the car.
Oh no.
Yeah. Like I said, that was pretty dumb. But we actually had somebody who had set up a heat tent and had like chicken noodle soup and hot coffee. And we named him VIP. I was like, this is the best ever.
Isn't that,
you know, makes you appreciate people.
Well, and it makes you appreciate the most basic foods too. I mean, after a long, hard day like that, and it's just like, here's some Progresso from a can, and it's just the greatest meal you ever had in your life.
Yes, I hate black coffee, and I was like, oh, black coffee.
anything to wake me up a little bit.
Yeah, it's warm liquid. I don't care.
Warm brown water. I'll take it.
Exactly.
Have you used a rebreather? It might be a dumb question to ask a cave diver, but have you done that?
Oh, no. Yeah, that's not a dumb question at all. Yes, actually, I'm that guy, Mike Young, actually owns Kiss Rebreathers, and I have a Sidewinder, and he's the one who kind of got us in on that one. So it's a side mount rebreather.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have seen a breather before. Like a lot of the back mount ones are these, they kind of sit on your back like a tank or something like that.
Yeah.
So, but this one, these are set up so it's two independent scrubbers and they kind of lay lower on your back by your tanks because we're all side mount set up. And so it's a low profile rebreather. Those things are great.
Yeah. Where have you used them? I mean, because you, I don't know, it kind of has to be the right scenario to qualify for a rebreather, right? I mean, it's got to be like, okay, this is going to be a long dive.
Oh, no.
No, not necessarily?
Well, I mean, not necessarily. It depends on, so if you think about it, like when you're on an expedition cave diving, you don't want to have to fill tanks, right? So when you're just breathing down tanks normally, you go through the tanks rather quickly. So a tank is good for one dive. When you're on a breather, you're sipping off that tank.
Uh-huh,
so yeah. Because it's only taking enough, right? So you, you know the concept of a breather?
You're reusing, or you're not reusing right. oxygen, but you're using all of the oxygen.
Right. So you like breathe in 21% and you exhale, I think it's like 18% oxygen, right? So then it adds a little bit, and then you have like a little bit of extra air, so you don't go too much on the oxygen. And so it's this, and it scrubs out your CO2 so that you can reuse everything. So anytime you're on an expedition, if you want to make your tanks last a lot longer, areas like the cave that we're exploring in Mexico, nobody's been in it before. So all this, it percolates really quickly. The limestone is super soft, and I have been in a whiteout in that cave. Mm. It's like it suddenly starts snowing on you, and then it just whites out.
What?
So if you want to keep your bubbles to a minimum, a breather is also very, very good. So it actually helps on sumps because you're not, you know, you're not exhaling and knocking any residue sediment off the ceiling. Mm. And then if you're going deep, helium is really expensive, and that helps make that last long as well.
Mm. All right, you brought up Mexico. We got to go down that road.
Oh, yeah.
What have you done down there?
Let's see. Well, it started off with a purification, and then I'm trying to think of what year that was. There was a guy we know who owned a cave diving magazine or a scuba diving magazine in Florida, and he was going down to the Yucatan and looking at and just exploring and finding cenotes. And so we packed up the truck one year and just drove there. we met a bunch of cavers and did Culebra, one of the pits up in northeastern Mexico. And then we left the dry cavers and we went down to the Yucatan and drove around with a Mayan interpreter and got to jump into all kinds of beautiful holes that were just crystal clear. A lot of them where we were going, they don't go anywhere. They're just rooms.
Yeah.
But a lot of them have formations. So you like float down. I mean, if you imagine like this giant bacon coming along the side, and you can get right up to it because you're just floating next to it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you're doing that scene if it goes, and I mean, they would jump in and we would do, you know, 10 cenotes a day. So we were working down there with Tammy Thompson. She's up in Wisconsin, and Dr. Tom Iliff from Texas A&M University. He's a professor for underwater biology. Hmm. So he does like underwater biology, so cave specific animals. And so we were helping, you know, he was looking for species, and it was just really, really great. I had such a good time down there on that first trip for me. We were going to go to Tulum, but we had a number of battery fires in the car. So we just turned around. Like about that time, like everything's, you know, when everything starts to break on your trips and you're like, okay, it's time to go. So, and we came back a number of times after that. We went down there and met up with another professor down there at the University of Merida and did some explorations on the caves around Chichen Itza.
Ooh.
And so he had, you know, a lot of different theories about, you know, Mayan history. And so we were kind of helping him categorize different cenotes. And so like we would go down and there would be like artifacts. So we would create a map, and then he would take it, and with his students, they would go and do all the archaeology using those maps. So the maps had to be, you know, a grade 5. So we, like underwater, we were having we took a tape. Normally underwater, when you're surveying, you knot your line every 10 feet.
Sure.
So as you come back, you can count, you know, and you kind of guesstimate and, you know, your distance. But there we actually had an underwater tape. So station to station, compass, front and back sides kind of thing.
Wow. Okay. So you knew exactly how much you had.
Yes. Yeah. So it had to be a specific, you know, very technical so that, you know, he could use it.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, that was another great trip. And I think that was in 2010. So we did that one with 2010, and we also went to Sistema Crustacea, and helped Joey Pakes. She was a University of California graduate student. And she was studying remipedes, which are these really neat underwater, like they look like centipedes.
Yeah, but they kind of swim in circles and stuff.
Yes, yeah. They swim and they like hunt the halocline, and they go up into like the freshwater and the saltwater, and it's really, really cool to see. So we were mapping around her station points so that she could also use those for her scientific paper. So,
cool.
That was really neat.
Now, well, how does that work? Okay, so was she then with you, or were you just collecting specimens to bring to her?
She was collecting specimens. We were mapping.
Oh, okay. So you were all kind of...
Our focus is mostly mapping.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. Because I don't know how that works sometimes, where you're working with a biologist who needs specimens, but they don't necessarily want to go caving.
Correct.
And so then you are then tasked to do it. Have you ever had to do anything like that?
Oh, yes, yes. So... Or they can't get there. So we've done some exploration in a system around Jasper, Tennessee. I collected a amphipod for Matt Niemiller. So certain things like, oh, what is this? You know, this species is here because they wanted to know, you know, what was going on there. Yeah, I've done some collections and brought them for them, or have had to place them. They're called YSI sons. They're an autonomous sampling unit. Ah. So you go, and it looks like a stick, right? And it's got all these sensors at the bottom for like dissolved oxygen, salinity, conductivity. And you put it somewhere, you know, you program it ahead of time and you put it out there and you just mount it to the ground and leave it. And then you go back and retrieve it for them. And so they get, you know, flow and all these other things that are really great. So I'm a biologist by profession, so it's easy to talk to them about that kind of stuff.
Oh, right on. So you know what they need. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
I guess we didn't get around to your profession.
It's okay.
How much does it intersect with your caving?
More now, believe it or not, than before. Before I was a biologist for the Department of Transportation in Tennessee. So I did environmental surveys for projects, and every now and then I'd come along a cave. So then I'd be like, oh, well, we have to explore this cave for the road. I was like, oh, shucks, you know. So, and then now I work for U.S. Fish and Wildlife. So I've been doing over here in Kauai, they have a listed spider. It's the Kauai wolf spider.
Ooh.
And an amphipod that it actually feeds on is also listed, and they're together and they're in dry caves. This is all dry caves.
Sure.
So we go, and last year we had a couple survey trips where we went and just kind of do population surveys.
It's nice to have a professional excuse to go to Kauai, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Yes. Twist my arm, you know.
Oh, so what are the, I mean, the lava's a little older in Kauai versus the Big Island, right?
Yeah, it is. And so the caves are pretty small. They're very humid. The spiders like really humid caves. And so it's mostly hands and knees, and you have to be close to the ground to look for spiders, which I have no problem with spiders. I found out that I do not like the big cane spiders. I don't know if you've ever seen a cane spider.
No, I don't think
imagine,
I have.
Google that.
Cane spider.
Cane spider, C-A-N-E, like sugar cane spider.
Yeah, okay. Oh, that is big.
Yeah. You're welcome. Have a nightmare.
Good heavens. That's like the huntsman spiders that you can find in Australia.
Are yes, yeah. I don't know if they're the same ones because I do not like those.
They're just that those are just a little too big for you.
Yeah, those are a little. Well, and part of it is like it's kind of like anything else, right? I'm fascinated, but I don't want to crawl into it. Right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's all fun and games until you're in a tight passage and a big spider moves in front of your face. Right? Like you're like, no.
I didn't see you until you started moving. You could have just kept still.
Oh. Yes. I have had quite the spider interaction in caves. So I almost drowned a girl one time because she knocked a spider off in front of my face and we were all floating. I'm just like, stop helping. So,
what are your grotto affiliations?
I am part of the Hawaii Grotto and the Nashville Grotto, although I haven't renewed my Nashville Grotto. But the Nashville Grotto is what I'm put at, I think, under the NSS.
Have you done grotto leadership in the past? I mean, you've been caving for 22 years, but have you?
Yeah. I was a chairman of the Nashville Grotto for a year. I'm on the board of the Hawaii Board of Governors. And then I was Sarah chair.
Oh, wow.
For a year. Yeah. You know that year that they, like, no grotto could do it, and so it was left up to the group who ran Sarah to do it?
Yeah.
That was my year. After they told me all I had to do was run the meeting, we ended up putting on Sarah.
So. I mean, what was it like for you to put on a caving event? Because I was chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto, and we put on Indiana Cave Capers every year, and not all grottos do an event every year, you know, and that,
right.
We used to have business meetings every month. When I was chairman, I got away from that. I was like, let's do every other month. We made it work, but you kind of jam things up when you do it that way, especially if you're putting on a big event. I mean, that's a big undertaking.
It was definitely harder than I thought it would be, but we tried to make it. It was called the Simple Sarah.
Mm.
And we didn't have a band. We're not going to have events. It's like, if somebody wants to set up the climbing competition, we didn't have anything like that. We gave out some awards at the end, and like, basically it was like, there's a t-shirt if you want. I did the book. It was definitely, I think we had a call every month. I think we had a call. I would have preferred not to have a call every every month. And then, like, site prep, we had it at Maureen Handler's place, Cavers Paradise. And so, you know, a lot of the stuff was already prepared. And so we would go out on the weekends, kind of help her prep for this. But luckily for us, because we had a venue like that, it was a lot easier than I think some of the other grottos have it, you know, because I helped the Nashville Grotto put on a Sarah one time, and it was way more involved than that. And I will say that after that, a lot of those people stopped hanging out with each other. You know how, like, participation suddenly goes way down?
Yes.
Like, people are like, I need a break.
Yeah, you get to the event, and it's just like, okay, we're here, we're doing it, that's it, okay. And then it's over, and it's like, thank God.
Yes.
This is, I have to approach this in a certain way, I guess. So sure. Cave diving isn't exactly something that I would imagine a cave diver wouldn't be eager to recommend cave diving to just anyone. But
right.
If a caver is hearing this and they've been caving for a while, they know what goes into caving, they've maybe Sherpa'd for some divers, and they maybe want to get into it themselves, what should they be thinking about? And I don't know, what would be their next step?
So the first step would be to get scuba and cave certified. So to go and find and do your research and find a reputable instructor, ask around, there's a handful of cavers. There's the CDS, but there's a handful of really active cavers that are also dry cavers and cave divers. Talk to them about because you're going to need a monetary investment.
Sure.
Obviously. So you're going to have to think about that. And so, and instruction costs money. And then after that, again, reach out to even to like me or, you know, Jason. We have brought people on who have wanted to learn, and we believe more in a mentorship.
Mm, like, of course,
I don't teach cave instruction. I expect you to already be cave certified. And then we will go through, like, and we will sit and talk with you about differences on, because you go to your class and you get trained, right? And they're like, this is how you do it. This is the only way you do it. This is what you should do. And then you go out of the class and you like try to apply that to real world. And we're so specific with, you know, sump diving and things like that, that a lot of things have to change.
Right.
And you have to change things. You have to be willing to do that. So you got to really ask yourself, are you going to be calm and cool? Because it's we've all had close calls. And so you have to realize that that may be in your future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sure. There's always going to be a time in emergencies.
Well, and just handling that the wrong way could mean bad things.
Yes. And diving with the right people who, like, when you are at your limit and you can't handle it, are right there with you. Because that's, you know, the thing. We dive in, we have our teams, you know, and you have your team, and you know that if something goes wrong and you are diving with someone, you can rely on them. So you need to be at a level where they can rely on you. And so practice, like, you're going to have to practice. And, you know, I'm practicing here in open water. I dive my cave setup in open water, because I need to remember how to do it. I need to be able to do drills and, you know, okay, this has gone wrong, or this has gone wrong. What's happened to me in the past? You know, what am I going to do? You know, where is this at? So practice, and then talk with people who actually do it, you know, and don't be afraid to ask. You know, don't realize that you're not going to come out of it knowing everything. Someone will always know more than you, or a different way to do it. I mean, there are definitely times where we've been doing it for so long, and then somebody else comes up with something else. I'm like, oh, I kind of like that. I'm like, why have we been doing it this way? So, you know, don't be afraid to suggest, but also be open to constructive criticism.
Yeah.
I would say, yeah, definitely talk. Mentorship, I think, is a huge thing. I really like that. And we're different from some of the cave divers in a lot of ways. Like, I'm going to admit something. I did not like cave divers as a caver.
Okay. I think that you can admit that. You're now one of them. And so that's a fun full circle thing.
But I found that still sometimes I'm like, oh, this is so ridiculous. You know, like, cavers, I always feel like are this, we all know we're not all laid back and all that stuff, but there's a jovial part to caving.
Yeah.
That is a lot of times missing in cave diving. And that's why, when you go and ask somebody and say they give you a crappy answer, they're not going to talk to you, don't give up on that. Go and talk to somebody else, you know, because experience is a big factor. And so, you know, don't be afraid to ask questions.
I don't know. From my perspective, though, I can't say that I'm that surprised that cave divers, some cave divers, could be a little sort of actively discouraging to people.
Yes. I could see that too. I mean, you see a lot of burning bright and then burn out.
Yeah.
And so a lot of cave divers only do it for so long, and they find that they don't like it. Like, you know, you may think that, oh, I'm going to be cave diving, but it's not all crystal clear and gorgeous and exploration. And some people are like, oh, I just want to follow the line. And that's fine. But it's a lot to wrap your head around sometimes.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Chrissy, this was so much fun and so insightful into the world of cave diving, and also, you know, your caving life. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. It was a great opportunity. I appreciate talking.
Oh, Chrissy, what a great time. That was a great conversation. Thank you so very much. And there it is. There's 2020. It may not have been a great year overall, for many of us, but at least it marks my second year in a row with 50-50 representation. Six men, six women, all representing the caving world, and I'm very, very proud of that, and I'm looking forward to 2021 being the exact same thing. And in 2021, I am planning on speaking to a bunch of California cavers in lead up to the 2021 convention in Weed, California. Can't wait to see you there. All right. I kind of feel like I have been playing this up a lot, so I'm going to go ahead and just reveal who I am, who I'm having kick off 2021 and say sayonara to 2020. I talked about how big this guest is last month, and I do still think that it is a huge, huge get, but I don't want to talk him up too much. Bill Steele. Bill Steele. I'm talking to Bill Steele. He's led numerous expeditions to Mexico over several decades. He's kind of the guy for Huautla. And I talked to him. It was It was amazing. He was great. He was fantastic. And I can't wait for you to hear the interview on January the 1st, New Year's Day. Bill Steele is going to be on the Caving Podcast. Support this podcast by supporting our sponsors, El Spelio. Go to elspelio.com and save $20 with the promo code podcast on any order of $300 or more of regularly priced items, or really any light that you can buy at elspelio.com. Also, support our past sponsors, Swago, swagogear.com. Get you a good Swago pack, you wet cavers. And also go to Organic Robot, be it the Etsy store or the brick-and-mortar location in Greenfield, Indiana, Organic Robot. Charlie, congratulations on the store. If you need shirts, custom shirts, screen-printed, printed, whatever you need, get in touch with Charlie. He can hook you up, all right? Is that all? I believe that's all. Also, Giving Tuesday, support your grotto, support your Karst Conservancy, support the NSS, whatever you can do. I think that's it. Is that it? Yeah. Until next time, kill nothing but time.